Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. South Carolina lawmakers have passed a bill banning most abortions after 6 weeks. More from CBS's Allison Keyes.
It is the second time South Carolina has approved a six-week abortion ban since Roe v. Wade was overturned. But the state Supreme Court overturned it because it violated the state constitution's right to privacy. Loyola Law Professor Jessica Levinson explains.
Because the language of the bill is different and because the composition of the state Supreme Court has changed, that they'll have better luck with this particular bill.
South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster has said he will sign it into law. Allison Keyes, CBS News.
New revelations in a report by the Illinois Attorney General's office after looking into allegations of sexual abuse by Catholic clergy. Back in 2018, a church review led investigators to believe just over 100 individuals crossed the line. Attorney General Kwame Raoul says that number now tops 450, and he credited accusers for coming forward.
Absent their courage and willingness to come forward and discuss their experience, there would be no true investigative report.
Raoul says the perpetrators may never be held accountable in a court of law, but his intention by naming them in his report is to provide public accountability. A Missouri man who drove a rented box truck into a White House barricade last night told Secret Service agents he planned the attack for 6 months. He's now charged with, among other things, threatening the president. CBS's Jeff Pegues.
Kangela stated that his goal was to get to the White House, seize power, and be put in charge of the nation. And would kill the president if that's what I have to do. The suspect was carrying the Nazi flag and, when asked, expressed admiration for Hitler.
The U.S. Surgeon General is calling for tech companies and lawmakers to take immediate action to protect kids and adolescents' mental health on social media. CBS medical contributor Dr. Celine Gounder.
The Surgeon General is calling for strong safety standards to protect kids against harmful content and excessive use, which might include creating tech-free zones in the home, like the bedroom or the dinner table. Talk to your kids about how social media makes them feel.
A Russian court has held a closed-door hearing against Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gerskovich on spying charges. The American citizen, his employer, and the U.S. government have denied the charges. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller.
We understand the hearing took place and that Russia extended the pre-trial detention of Evan Gerskovich by an additional 3 months. We once again call on Russia to comply with their obligation to provide consular access to him.
Guam residents stock up and batten down as a super typhoon closes in. This is CBS News.
Find your next great hire with Indeed. Their hiring platform makes it easy to attract, interview, and hire candidates all in the same place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Local radio for your community. Civic Media broadcasting across the state of Wisconsin.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane Matinair. Here's what you need to know. Parents at Monday night's meeting of the Grafton School Board expressed frustration over the handling of a teacher at John Long Middle School. David Schrader is facing a felony charge of terrorist threats. Prosecutors say he threatened his students in class earlier this month after Schrader found two students with a swastika drawing and told the class, quote, "I wish pain on you and all your families," unquote. Schrader also said he owned 17 guns. Schrader, who is Jewish, wasn't arrested until hours after the incident after a parent called police. In Burlington, a memorial of flowers and candles continues growing in honor of 16-year-old Jack Myers. The junior at Burlington High School was struck and killed by a train Sunday afternoon. Investigators say Myers tried to cross the tracks while the warning signals were activated. I'm Jane Matinair. This is Civic Media News.
Have fun on the lake this summer. Treat yourself and find the watercraft you want at Action Boathouse Showroom just south of 59 on 164 in Waukesha. Check out the fun and versatile Sea-Doo Switch with its powerful Rotex jet engine. Action Boathouse Showroom also has a selection of luxury fishing boats or pontoon boats from seven top USA manufacturers. The team at Action Boathouse Showroom is excited to help you launch into the sun this season and onto the lake. Action Boathouse Showroom just north of 59 on 164 in Waukesha.
This is the story of a very special woman. Just a few knew about her superpowers. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
A no-holds-barred political conversation. That's Matt Flynn Direct.
Anybody running against Trump, if he calls them a nasty name, they should hit him back twice as hard. This is not the Marcus of Queensberry gentleman's rules anymore. In politics, certainly not in the Republican Party. Hit him hard.
Matt Flynn Direct. Weekday afternoons from 3 until 4 on the Civic Media Network and on the Civic Media app. Log on civicmedia.us.
You are listening to your local Civic Media radio station on air. Thank you. Did you know we are always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app too? And if you miss a show or game, find it wherever you get your podcasts or on our website, civicmedia.us.
And I was saying, look, you know, our government doesn't work the same way. We can argue that it should. It doesn't. It's got 350 million people that it's got a service. And some get serviced a lot better than others, and you know, some use chapstick while doing it. And others are left out in the cold. And this is one of those moments where, you know, when you look at the cuts that are being talked about, we're going to go after TANF, we're going to go after work requirements for any help for, you know, people over 50s. You know, they're narrowly putting this out there so that they can look like the good guys. And what it is just kicking the door open. And what they've learned, and this is where, you know, where I went to this, I said Republicans have learned that the Democrats will give in because they care. This is the fatal flaw of most Democrats. They have compassion, they have empathy, they have sympathy, they care for others, they care about their neighbors, they care about their communities, they care about their kids, they care about other people's kids. They care. They are not going to burn the house down. That's not in their nature. Now, my conservative friends, I truly believe they'll burn it down. That this hostage situation, this one's different than the past ones. This one, I do believe they really do want to shoot the hostage. And I point to Matt Gaetz, who I guess, you know, decided, hey, it's open season. Everyone knows it's a hostage situation. Everyone knows Republicans are holding the country hostage. So he said, hey, you know, I think my conservative colleagues, for the most part, support Limit, Save, Grow. That's their bill. And they don't feel we should negotiate with our hostage. Did he just admit that the American people are their hostages? Did he just admit that the country is their hostage and they've got this leverage, they've got this moment to get all of their wet dream list passed? Oh, we can cut VA funding, we can cut food stamp funding, we can cut housing assistance, we can cut all of those programs that, you know, help people, while simultaneously ensuring that our very well-to-do are very well-to-do. Now, what I find interesting is I've had it posed to me a number of times that this is Biden versus McCarthy. This is the two of them. This is the red hat, blue hat. And I've said, no, I don't think the frame is that at all. I think Biden has said, look, you've got to do your job. So come back when your job is done. But this is really the Republican Party, the hostage takers, and the hostages, us. It's the Republican Party against us. Biden's just there. He said what he's willing to do. And I had this conversation today of being like, look, let's say the money's in the bank. Congress already spent the money. It's already out the door. It's already allocated. It's already earmarked. It's already in the account. The executive's job is just to write the checks. The purse, people who spent the money. It's already spent. It's already there. It's already been allocated. It's already planned. It's already moving. You can't then come back and go, well, we've now changed our minds and we're going to hold you hostage while doing it. It's not a way to run a lemonade stand, let alone one of the more powerful countries on earth. Now, the thing is, and I talked about this yesterday, most people, I guess the polling is pretty consistent in the 60% range. Most people want cuts. We should be cutting stuff. And as I said, I'm not opposed to cutting things. It's what are we cutting? What are our priorities? What is it that we, as moral beings, as compassionate beings, as empathetic beings, what is it we're willing to cut? Are you literally going to take food out of the mouths of children? And, you know, I think about the former governor of Maine, Paula Page. Remember Paula Page, who used to joke about that he was excited when he could take candy away from children. That was a high point for him. I see him as kind of the conservative way of thinking today. Wish I was wrong. Wish it weren't true. But when you start talking about what should we be cutting, should we be cutting, basic infrastructure things? Should we be cutting necessities? that safety net that keeps people from falling through? Or should we slash and burn and let people fall where they may? And are we the society that's going to allow homeless people to starve to death on the streets? Are we the society that's going to go, hey, well, sorry, you couldn't get health insurance. You're on your own. Are we that country now? Because I tell you, I think we're moving there. I think as conservative states become more powerful, as Republicans take over more legislatures, and we move to the states' rights arguments that let the states decide, I think you'll see states that are going to be willing to allow people just to languish on the streets. And you know, occasionally you'll get some lip service, but for the most part, do you see policies out there that are going to help move us in a positive direction? I don't. And this is where my frustration is. Now, both Biden and McCarthy came out today. No one's close to a debt limit increase. And I don't know that we're going to get there by June 1st. We could default. And that's going to cause real problems. It could trigger a sizable recession, as some economists are saying, quite possibly is going to happen. So you ask yourself why. If you know what the consequences are, if you know what you're doing and you go into it open-eyed, open-minded, say, you know what, this is so important, taking food away from children and kicking people out of their homes and doing all the things that will happen once the cuts that they've thrown out there happen. Is it that important? Is it that important to them? And the answer evidently is yes, it is that important. It is their ideology. But more importantly, the only way they're going to hold on to 2024 is if there is a recession. The only way that they can get people to be angry and outraged and go to the polls is if economically they're struggling. Because understand, people are pretty riled up over the abortion issue. And as more jobs keep coming online and we start rebuilding more things, more people are going to start turning around their thinking to going, hey, maybe this is the right way to go. Question is can Republicans hold on long enough? Will our apathy, will our attention span serve us long enough that we're going to remember? Republicans are hoping that we don't. And they need a good crisis so they can take advantage of it. To me, it's very clear. We have raised the debt ceiling. I don't even know how many times, 100 times, 90 times. And as my friend Bob Nay says, it was always a yawn vote because you already spent the money. The time to argue about spending would be, I don't know, maybe before you spend it. Do you want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Got lots to get to, lots to talk about. Quick break, right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So according to an AP NORC poll, Americans aren't happy with the economy. In fact, only 21% of adults think that we are moving in the right direction. Count me in there. I think we are making the decisions and doing the things that are moving us in the right direction. The problem is we've got a media culture that plays on negativity. Oh, they play on negativity. Only 36% of Democrats say that we're going in the right direction. 7% of Republicans. I'm surprised it's that high. 24% say the economy is in good shape. 76 thinks it's in poor condition. And here's the weird thing. No matter how much Republicans try, they can't push us into a recession. I mean, no matter how much the Federal Reserve tries, they can't push the country into a recession. They can't do it. I don't know why. Resilience of American spending? I don't know. But it's quite remarkable. And what's I was reading an Atlantic article here earlier today. No, actually, it was Washington Monthly. The Atlantic was a different one. Washington Monthly said, you know, the reality is inflation is coming down. Wages are going up. You know, why is it that Biden isn't getting credit for this? And the reality is they do a crummy job. And Democrats do a crummy job of taking credit for things. If Trump were in the White House, this is the reality. If Trump were in the White House, this would be the greatest economy that ever existed. The best job growth ever existed. You know, you would think that they were handing out gold bullion on the street corners. It would be that kind of PR pitch, that kind of self-promotion. And Democrats just don't do it. And it's one of those things where you go, you know, I know all these people are disapproving of the economy sucks, all this stuff, because they're told constantly how bad things are. You remember when eggs were $9 a dozen? Oh my God, eggs are $9 a dozen. Joe Biden's fault. I just saw him at the store for $1. Anybody going, that's Joe Biden's fault? No. And as this stuff continues to drop, and look, I think we need to do a lot more to help move this along, but things are moving in the right direction because of the policies that are being moved on. We're investing in infrastructure. We're reshoring manufacturing, which we desperately need. And to prove this, you know, I happened to catch this American Conservative article. Yes, I do read the American Conservative website because I want to know what the other side's saying. They evidently have come around to what I've been saying for how long I've been doing this show? Oh yeah, 18 years now. They've now finally the epiphany, the dawn that maybe deindustrialization was a bad thing. Maybe the post-industrial economy of white shirts and corner offices and paper shuffling, maybe not such a great idea. And as they say, you know, 40 plus years of outsourcing, you know, has left the nation's industrial engine rusted. Can't disagree with that. This article says, look, you know, foreign dependence has jeopardized our defense. It's jeopardized our innovation, and it's harmed our living standards. No. Really? Who's been saying that for 18 years now? Oh, yeah, I have. And others have been saying it a lot longer. Look, I'm not Magellan discovering new things either. But when you give away your manufacturing base, not like we lost it. It's not like they outcompeted us. We got a bunch of rich people who said, hey, we can make more money overseas. We can profit mightily and create more of us. And of course, you poor working schlubs, you're going to have to be retrained. And as they point out in this article, the financial sector did well. And as they say, China became the industrial superpower, the 21st century arsenal of autocracy. Now remember, you know, our manufacturing prowess, go back to World War II, the arsenal of democracy. We handed that over to the Chinese. Because they now have the world's largest shipbuilding industry. They've got a fleet that we can't match. They point out in the article that if we got into a missile war, we got like a week's worth. And then it's going to take us about 2 years to produce what we need. We're that heavily dependent. And they point out that, you know, China has moved ahead of us in 37 out of 44 critical and emerging science and technology fields. There was this report put out by the U.S. State Department and Special Competitive Study that said, hey, we're not competitive. What we are doing, well, what we do really well, we complain. We complain like nobody's business. We get in other people's affairs like nobody's business. But we've given away our manufacturing. And this is something working class people have known for years, because it was them who took it on the chin. And, you know, they said, look, this post-industrial economy, the myth that rationalized U.S. deindustrialization, it was bad. This is the American conservative. Conservatives were out in front pushing this. The neoliberals were there too, the Clintonites and them. But what we saw was, because the rich wanted to get richer, because we were sold on Wall Street more than Main Street, is, well, we lost our manufacturing. And as I've been saying for years, and I think back to a former friend of mine who was a congressman. He worked as a suit maker. And he used to tell the story about one of his friends invented a machine that used to make, you know, the semiconductor chips by using one of the sewing machines, that in his garage, he was tinkering around with an old machine. You know, innovation, where innovation happens, you happen to have this stuff, you're just playing around with it because you're using it all day at work and you thought of some new way of using it. That's gone. We don't do those things anymore. People don't have those skills anymore. And as they point out in the article, once we lost this manufacturing prowess, once we were no longer the arsenal of democracy and the leader of industrial production in the world, skills started to wane. And this is what I was having this conversation 18 years ago, saying, look, as we lose all these jobs and we lose the manufacturing capacity, as we lose machinists, as we lose the people who can take a chunk of steel and turn it into whatever you want, as those people retire and die off and there's no generation learning from those people, we lose the skill. And you're no more than two generations away from it being all gone. Hello, here we are. They point out in the article that, gee, huh, who knew there was a direct link between having the shop floor and the engineers right in the same place? Who knew? Who knew that was important to have people who knew how the widgets worked and then, you know, went home into their garage and tinkered with them? This is my problem with doing away with tinkering. And a big problem I have with the John Deere's of the world and our defense contractors who don't let you fix anything, because everything inside of it is proprietary. And while we were trying to figure out how we're going to develop the next gig economy widget, the next delivery app, or the next social media algorithm to get people hooked on watching whatever nonsense you're shoving before their eyes, countries like China and India were talking about, hey, how do we produce? And they went in and they talked about the number of things that we created. Solar photovoltaic cells, heavy castings and forgings, machine tools, permanent magnets, rare earth element refining, LED manufacturing, rechargeable batteries, semiconductors, liquid crystal displays, precision glass, fiber optic components, all of this stuff we created. And the Chinese now dominate. And look, you know, the experiment of deindustrialization and the post-industrial economy is a failure. Because as they point out, gee, who knew that, you know, that blue-collar worker down at the factory had not just, you know, economic, losing those jobs didn't just have economic ramifications, also had national security ramifications. If you don't produce, you can't ramp it up. And this is where I come back to. I like what Biden has been doing, reshoring some manufacturing. Do I think we need a Marshall Plan to move us faster? Absolutely. We need to redo our grid. We need massive amounts of investment. Not just the $1.2 trillion that we've got now. We need massive investments, like we're going to war, because guess what? That's how the Chinese see it. And until we get our heads out of the sand, we're going to keep losing. So drop the red hat, drop the blue hat. It's time to pick up a hard hat and get back to work.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day the Lucas County Sheriff ordered an attack on thousands of electric auto light strikers and unemployed league supporters, touching off the six-day Battle of Toledo. The Toledo auto light strike was one of three historic strikes of 1934 that turned the tide favorably toward industrial organizing. The auto light company had granted a wage increase, but reneged on promises of a first contract that included seniority rights, a closed shop, and more. Workers walked off the job in mid-April. As the strike was about to collapse, unemployed league forces, organized by A.G. Musty's American Workers Party, joined picket lines in support. When legal wrangling failed to subdue the strike, scabs and deputized specials were amassed. And on this day, the picket lines grew to as many as 10,000. Deputies began arresting strike leaders and attacking picketers with fire hoses, tear, and vomit gas. Historian Brian Palmer describes the scene this way. Angry workers laid siege to the factory. 1,500 strike breakers were imprisoned. The scene was one of almost medieval tumult. Windows were smashed with stones and bricks, many of them launched from giant slingshots improvised from rubber inner tubes. When every window in the factory had been smashed, one striker shouted, "Now you have your open shop." The next day, 900 Ohio National Guardsmen arrived on the scene. Women jeered the landing of the Marines, while soapboxers, many of them veterans, sporting First World War medals, offered impromptu lectures on how the troops were breaking the strike. The strikers' ranks faced a hail of guardsmen bullets, which left two dead and scores wounded. The battle raged on until the end of May, when it was clear a general strike was imminent.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
If poobahs of the National Democratic Party wonder why working-class families, which once formed the party's solid base of political support, have gone astray, they might ponder the awful message they're sending by constantly smooching Senator Joe Manchin's tail. The multimillionaire West Virginia coal baron and anti-democratic Democrat is demanding that a massively polluting pipeline named Mountain Valley be rammed through rivers, watersheds, national parks, and down the throats of the people of West Virginia, Virginia, and North Carolina. Why? Money. The senator's fossil fuel funders, who own the project, want the federal government to mandate construction of their corporate boondoggle. For a decade, gutsy grassroots groups have rebelled and defeated these Wall Street profiteers, and the people of this Appalachian region are still adamantly opposed. But here comes Biden to rescue Manchin and his fossil fuelers with a dirty backroom deal overruling the will of the people, proclaiming that he wants to advance America's conversion from fossil fuels to renewable energy. Biden is pushing a bill to make it easier and faster to get federal approval for new energy projects. Fine. But his bill specifically greases the skids for more fossil fuel projects. And guess which one is the first in line for quick approval? Yes, Brother Joe Manchin's Mountain Valley Pipeline. Pumping frack gas through three states would produce a mess of leaks and spills, but the project would also emit some 40 million metric tons of planet-warming gas a year, equivalent to the annual pollution of 10 coal plants. As the Natural Resources Defense Council puts it, we won't build the clean energy economy of the future by doubling down on the dirty fuels of the past. This is Jim Hightower saying, for information and action on this raw deal, connect with Appalachian Mountain Advocates, appvoices.org.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I'm sure everyone saw the 60 Minutes piece on the Pentagon, and I think the graphic that they had at the very beginning was perfect. You had the Pentagon with a giant screw right through the middle of it with a price tag on it saying price gouging. Because when you look at the fact that the number the guy gave out, when they negotiate these contracts for things that we need, they negotiate in a nice, healthy profit. 12 to 15% seems very reasonable. But the guy said they're taking about 40% now. When you look at the fact that our $842 billion budget, half of it is going to defense contractors, this might be something we should be talking about with this whole debt ceiling thing. If you really want to start cutting stuff, maybe the profits to these handful of defense contractors, maybe we could put that on the table. Just a thought. But here to share some thoughts on, well, the 60 Minutes piece and really what it says and what it means for the direction of our country and policy-wise what we need to be doing. So I've asked my good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, their website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, good to be with you.
So the 60 Minutes piece, we've been talking about this stuff for years. I don't think there's anything new in it. We've all heard about the $300 or $400 toilet seat or the $500 hammer. But this kind of puts some new stuff on it. The fact that we went from 51 defense contractors down to just 5 over a very short period of time. And that was a policy choice that I think we can undo.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, and it's indicative of a lot of what we see in the overall economy, right? There's a lot of concentration, monopolistic behavior. And when there are few participants in the market, they control more of the juice, right? Which means they can set the prices and there's not the competitive pressures that otherwise would fall on them. And I guess the thing that really bugs me about this, Rick, is that, you know, we're at a time in our nation's history, I think, where in so many ways we need to be doubling down on our national security capabilities, right? Our ability to produce munitions, to produce rockets. You know, the burn rate of rockets is thousands per day, and we can only make thousands per month, basically, right? And if we want to gear up to provide a credible deterrence to China, you know, and there was just this war game that was done, you know, if there's a Taiwan conflict and the U.S. would run out of missiles in like a week or something like that. So we have all this spending, but we have like hardly any of this capability. And so it's like, and you're right, it's kind of like a lot of it goes either to wasteful programs or gets caught up in this monopolistic behavior that has resulted in price gouging. And so I do think that we need to examine it. And even with some of the savings of that, you could apply to the stuff that we need to do from a national security basis, that we really need to do to ramp up our capabilities.
Now, I keep asking who's going to be the, and I've been asking this for a couple of decades now, who's going to be this generation's Teddy Roosevelt, a trust buster, going to break up some of these monopolies? Who's going to be this generation's Harry Truman to go after the war profiteers and hold people accountable? You know, and I'm sadly, I'm not seeing it enough. I think this should be a national outcry. I know we're all concerned about who goes to what bathroom and what beer people drink or don't drink. I know we've got our important issues, but this seems kind of important too.
Yeah, it's more than important. I mean, one of the foundations of everything we take for granted as Americans is our ability to have a credible national defense. And it's served us well, I think, in World War II and since that time. And, you know, we've had our ups and downs, but having that is important. And when you see when you see what's happening today, it's frustrating. And I guess this is the thing about it. It's like, as you've indicated, and particularly on the issues we talk about on trade, like this isn't new. I mean, who first raised the serious concerns about the military-industrial complex?
Eisenhower.
You know, Dwight Eisenhower in the 1950s. And so we've had a lot of time to consider this and to get it right, but we're still not there, Rick. Yeah.
No, I mean, I agree with Eisenhower. You know, for every gun, every missile, you know, those are people who hunger and aren't fed, children who don't get education or health care. I mean, it's all of those things. These are priorities that are misplaced, especially when, and this is where I get, you know, just angry beyond belief, especially when you have these corporations and these wealthy folks who are gouging us in a time of crisis. I mean, this is the part that just blows my mind, and why we put up with it. And I don't think we know enough about it. I don't think there are enough 60-minute pieces like this. Because as you've said, I've been talking about this kind of stuff for years. I've been talking about deindustrialization for years. I've been talking about, you know, China's rise by taking over our manufacturing prowess. And, you know, you tell people, they look at you like you got a third head.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And look, we've all seen this as consumers, how our erosion of industrial capabilities has impacted us. We saw that during the pandemic when you had a hard time getting toilet paper or, you know, personal protective equipment or semiconductors or a lot of stuff. And again, we take for granted that we have an incredible national security capability. And we've been very fortunate that we've avoided large-scale conflicts, or the conflicts we have entered into have been on our own terms. But if we have to have the capacity to be able to do that, and despite all of that spending on defense, it doesn't exist. I mean, that war game with respect to Taiwan showed it, that like we'd run out of missiles in a week, you know, and it's like, where'd all this spending go? Yeah. So, yeah, we got to do something about
It went into billionaires' pockets. I mean, we know where a lot of it went.
Yeah.
That Office of Waste, Fraud, and Abuse that people talk about, I think a big part of it is in our defense industry. And look, I'm a Teddy Roosevelt kind of guy. I believe you walk softly, carry a big stick. I want to have a strong military. I want them to have everything that they need. You know, maybe not everything that they want, but what they need, they should have to keep our shores safe. But this is crazy. And now I look at China as I was just talking a moment ago about this American conservative piece about, you know, the post-industrial economy failing, like it's some kind of great epiphany. This has been 40 years in the making. This has been a situation where we didn't lose our manufacturing capacity. We gave it away, and we gave it away for a handful of people to get wealthier. And what I found interesting is as they were going through their realization of how bad this is, of how fast we lose skills, how fast we lose innovation, how fast we lose the ability to make the next widget or whatnot or machine or technological advancement, and how now we're kind of screwed in this moment.
Yeah. And wait, and I'm saying this kind of rhetorically. Yeah, what publication was that in again, Rick?
The American Conservative. I mean, this is where we can take off our red hats and blue hats and pick up a hard hat, because we got a lot of work to do. When they pointed out China now leads in 37 of 44 critical and emerging science and technology fields. Remember, we're number one. I thought, my finger, number one, chest thumping. We're number one, Scott, except in 37 out of 44 emerging science and technology fields.
Yeah. And it's no accident. I mean, that this is happening. And I thought that piece was very well argued, very well written. And I think that, you know, there is this growing consensus that, you know, neoliberalism, free trade agreements, deindustrialization, financialization, this all went too far. And I guess I think you can add concentration of industry to that as well. And that it's produced this really, really vulnerable situation for the United States. And I guess this is the danger, is that we've done some things, like we've done this this piece with respect to trying to rebuild the semiconductor industry in the United States, or to invest in our infrastructure, or to jumpstart some clean energy manufacturing. But that is the tip of the iceberg. That is the tip of the iceberg. There's so much out there where there is this lack of capacity, and it's gonna flare up a lot, and we're gonna see it in medicines. In fact, we already have. We've saw it in semiconductor. We can see it in other microelectronics. And as it moves ahead, we're gonna see it with respect to critical minerals that are needed for the batteries for electric vehicles, and then the list just goes on and on and on and on. And unless we have a strategy and say we want to make things here, what the market is going to give us is 1,000 new dollar stores a year, you know, which is not going to win a war for us, or not going to cure cancer, or not going to create middle class jobs in this country. And so we need to, this industrial policy, we're at the very beginning of this, at the very beginning of this, but it has to be much, much deeper, much broader, and sustained. And I'm glad that we've started down this road, but we shouldn't pretend like we've completely changed the game for manufacturing yet.
I think we've just awakened. You and I have had conversations for years that we need to have, and I've been saying for years that we need to have a Marshall Plan size, program to reshore manufacturing and upgrade our capacity to not just defend ourselves, but to supply ourselves. You talked about pharmaceuticals. We've got a neighbor who's battling cancer, not able to get the medicines that they need because who knows where they're made or where they're sourced or any of this stuff, because we've outsourced, we've given that all that stuff away, and literally people are going to die because of it.
They will. And you've seen rationing, you've seen shortages. I mean, I have a prescription for a product that totally has to do, it's not a life-threatening condition or anything like that, but for the past 6 months, it's been on back order almost every time, and it's taken weeks and weeks and weeks to get. And many people are experiencing this, and particularly in some of these cancer drugs as well. And there's a lot of reasons for them, but one of it is that fundamentally we don't make enough of the active pharmaceutical ingredients, enough of the compounds to go into that, or have enough of the manufacturing capacity to do it. And all of that like migrated to China, to India, to other countries. And we need to start restoring this. And again, there is some realization of this. And I've seen like good work that's going on in like Richmond, Virginia, in that area, in some other places. But we're just at the very beginning of these, and they're able to address one or two medicines and not the hundreds of medicines that are out there that we need to take care of. But this is again where we need an industrial policy. We need to say we're going to make this stuff here, and we're going to get some capital to put some factories here. We're going to have the right kind of incentives, including developing a government market, Buy America. Like, you know, if you're on Medicare or you're in the veterans program, and we're paying for prescriptions, those need to be sourced from the United States of America, and to utilize that as a lever for the pharmaceutical companies and the other companies involved in the supply chain to move this back to the United States as quickly as they can.
Yeah, but this is my problem, Scott. Should we have to have legislation? Should we have to have policies stuck into this stuff to say, take care of your home? I mean, you know, I think back to, you know, I guess I'm getting older, but you know, the whole flag waving patriotic thing was internalized. You thought about home first. You wanted to help overseas. You wanted to help other places. But home, that's what you took care of first. You didn't need to be recognized for doing the right thing and ensuring that where your home base is taken care of. I guess I'm still struggling with this idea that, oh yeah, we're going to screw over entire towns and communities and move a factory halfway across the world because I can make a penny or two more. I'm still struggling with that.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the dilemmas we've seen with the version of capitalism that we have. And it's not a stakeholder capitalism. It's totally based on weighted towards shareholders. And it's based on a theory, right, that conservative economists had at the time. And that unfortunately the markets and corporate leaders abide by. And it's this, and it's also this idea that they're still willing to wrap themselves in the flag, you know, in advertising and when it's convenient for them. But yeah, they would completely, totally, as you indicated, Rick, shut a factory down, send it overseas, not worry about any of the other impacts on communities, national security. And unfortunately, under the law, they can do that at virtually no cost now. Like, there's not much of a penalty for moving factories overseas. Or, you know, what do you do with the workers? They're not really responsible for having to clean up that mess in many occasions. And so unfortunately we do have to do a lot of this through policy, through legislation, through regulation, to bring it back here. And again, we're seeing some results, but it took 40 years to get into this mess. We're not going to turn around in 4 years, but I think we've at least paused a lot of this, not all of it, but a lot of it. And we're seeing some signs that, Yeah, at least some folks get it and are bringing stuff back to the United States.
I saw a video clip of Bob Lighthizer testifying, and he was saying, look, one of the greatest things you can possibly do for U.S. manufacturing, when I've talked to someone who doesn't believe there's a serious threat, I'm always like, oh, you must have investments in China. And he's saying, look, we need to remove the trade status, the permanent normal trade relations that we have, the trade status with China, and we need to do it now.
Yeah, I completely agree with the former trade ambassador, with Bob Lighthizer. I mean, he's been around these issues for a long time, and he may be a Republican who worked in the Trump administration, but he's also, in my humble opinion, been, you know, along with Katherine Tai, the best trade representatives we've had, because they are like, you know, our goal is not to negotiate free trade agreements. It's actually to bring jobs back to the United States and to use our trade policy to do that. And I think both of them agree that we got to do that. But Lighthizer is right. We should not have permanent normal trade relations for China. What the hell have they done to deserve it? You know, nothing. And they violate every agreement they make with us. They poke our eye on a lot of different issues. And we have this massive trade imbalance. And there's no indication that they're ever going to change. And so, you know, having this is a gift to Beijing. And there ought to be strings attached. There ought to be totally strings attached to it. And the only way we do that is by repealing permanent normal trade relations and conditioning it on China playing by the rules.
Yeah, but Scott, we won't get our cheap stuff from Walmart.
Well, trust me, Walmart will find other ways to make a dollar, and they already are. And I guess this is the thing, is that and this is why Lighthizer is right about this. You know, the tariffs that were put on in the Trump administration, there's a lot of criticism about it. But fundamentally, in one important way, they have worked. The category of products, and by the way, it's only like a third of the products coming in the United States. And most of them aren't like consumer products, okay? They're like intermediate goods, we would call them. But the trade deficit on those covered products has dropped dramatically since those tariffs have been in effect. And some of that work has come to the United States. Some of it's gone to our allies. Some of it's gone to other countries. But it's not in China anymore,
yeah.
which is very important. Whereas the trade balance on the other goods that aren't subject to the tariffs is just as bad as it always was. So the lesson there: tariffs work. They can adjust where our imports are coming from, and we should look at that very carefully as we move ahead and consider our next moves.
Yeah, it was one of the things that I was 100% behind Trump on, and the Trump administration wanted him to go even further. Would have been better if they'd had an actual plan after that. But you know, right. I was 100% on board with the tariffs. Last question I've got for you. You know, I now see Elon Musk moving vehicles that were supposed to be made for domestic production, domestic consumption in China. Evidently, there's talk of them going to Canada. How soon do they come here?
Yeah, I hope never. I mean, this really burns me up, because, you know, he put this factory in Shanghai and said, well, this is the only way I can sell in China, and that's all I'm going to do. And again, we have seen this. So many companies do this. So many guys say, oh, we're just moving to China to sell to that market. And then, you know, a few years later, they're like, you know what? It's too good to be true. So let's bring them back to the United States. And we ought to slap punitive tariffs on any vehicle coming from China, just because there is no level playing field there, Rick. There's no level playing field at all for cars coming from the United States. And they should not get here. And shame on Canada. Shame on Canada, too. If a bunch of them end up there, that's yeah. Not the way this is supposed to turn out. And Elon Musk just has really screwed North American workers over.
This is where the whole idea of tearing down borders for capital and goods was a horrible idea, in my view. I've got some people who disagree with me, but I think when we tore down borders for capital and for products, things went straight off the cliff, and the working class in all countries ended up taking it on the chin. It's just, I have a huge problem with it.
Yeah. Yeah, we need to get back to that worker-centered trade policy. Yep. That's not just blinded by a philosophy of free trade agreements and do what's right. And a lot of times, honestly, That includes tariffs.
Yep. Do what's
right. It totally does.
Simple stuff. Do what's right. Scott, I appreciate the time as always. Good stuff. I look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Can't wait. Look forward to it, Rick. Thank you.
Want to hear your thoughts? Should we be reshoring manufacturing? Should we be fighting for this? And do we have the elected officials who are going to do it? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 2003. That was the day that the U.S. Senate approved more than $300 billion in tax cuts over the next decade. The cuts barely passed. Vice President Dick Cheney cast the deciding vote 51-50. Starting in 2001, President George W. Bush proposed and pushed for a series of drastic tax cuts. The administration promised the changes would help to create jobs and grow the economy. But the results fell far short of that goal. 10 years after the massive tax cuts, the Washington Post ran a story analyzing their impact. The article stated, quote, "By any measure, the Bush tax cuts have benefited the wealthy more than the middle class. The top 20% of earners received 73% of the tax relief. The bottom 20% only received 1%. Coupled with spending on wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, the tax cuts sent the national debt soaring. And those promised jobs? They never materialized. 2001 to 2007 marked the worst period of job growth since the 1950s. Then, in 2008, the recession wiped out 8 million jobs. Many of the Bush tax cuts were designed to sunset or expire after so many years. Yet when it came time for the cuts to end in 2010, Republicans in Congress fought to keep them going. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka declared, "It is absolutely insane that in these tough economic times, some people want to continue George W. Bush's tax giveaways to millionaires. Working families are losing their jobs, their benefits, and their homes. They are the ones who need help." The Bush tax cuts finally expired in 2013, although new legislation repackaged and continued many of them. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So the governor of South Carolina, Henry McMaster, evidently Henry was talking before the state's GOP convention over the weekend and had a little quip, you know, got to get that dig in there against Democrats. He said, "I look forward to the day that Democrats are so rare, we have to hunt them with dogs." Yeah. No, what's interesting, South Carolina, probably the majority of the Democratic Party, they're black folks. They're people of color. I don't know. South Carolina's history as being the kind of state that it is seems like dog whistle politic, doesn't it? Seems like inciting, at least at the minimum, inciting some political violence, talking to the good old boys. You know, we get to go get them with our dogs. I got a problem with that. Just do. It's a, and now his excuse was, "Oh, shucks, boy. Yeah, y'all know he was just a kidding." No one knows you were just kidding. And the thing is the more this kind of thing goes unchallenged, the more these good old boy jokes, they're not jokes. The more the white supremacy and the Nazi mentality is allowed to fester, the more crazy stuff we have. Last night, for instance, somebody was driving a U-Haul truck, drove into Lafayette Square near the White House. Nazi paraphernalia in the cab. So it got me thinking. I'm like, you know, geez, you know, you see all this terrorism going on. You see all this stuff that you know, white supremacists and Nazis are doing. I haven't heard much about Al-Qaeda lately. It makes me wonder if they haven't outsourced terrorism to the white supremacists and the Nazis. Maybe they work cheaper. I don't know. But this is one of those moments where you go, maybe we need to start cracking down on domestic terrorism. Maybe we need to start holding some of these groups accountable. No, couldn't do that. Because we don't have a cute little catchphrase. Like Islamo fascist terrorism stuff.
You're listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.